a City of Daytona Beach special magistrate proceeding for TPA denial and Bike Week 2013 master plan appeals. Before we proceed, are there any announcements I need to be made aware of?
None that I'm aware of, sir.
All right. With that, will the representatives of the City of Daytona Beach who will be testifying at this morning's proceedings please step forward and be sworn?
Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to provide is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
All right, case one, Daytona Pit Stop, 42 South Atlantic Avenue. Anyone here for the respondent?
Yes.
Please step forward.
I'm Walter Foster, 315 South Meadow Avenue, Daytona Beach.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, well, he's waving, wanting to know whether we should come up or not. Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's right. This is Charlie Fedita, who is the owner of Daytona Pit Stop, Inc.
And
he very well might be. You might want to swear in there.
Okay. Could you step up to the microphone and state your name and raise your right hand, please?
Charlie Fedita.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to provide is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
All right. Counselor, go ahead.
Thank you. This is before you today as an appeal of the denial of the TPA permit based on order of noncompliance that was issued on December 19th. And Mr. Fedita, timely appeal, so this is set before you today. As my understanding, it was continued from an earlier meeting. It's the position of the applicant on this, and before I begin, he hasn't had a fine imposed in the last 3 years. He's not subject to any unpaid fine or assessment. He's appealing the order, which is finding noncompliance for having a shirt rack outside on November 10th, 2012. And he is the principal of the corporation. So, I mean, is it your preference that I do this through testimony or argument?
Well, first off, I assume the basis for the appeal, it's his denial of a temporary promotional activity permit because he'd been found in noncompliance. I assume it was by the code enforcement board on December 19th of 2012.
That's correct.
I'm not aware of any appeal of that determination having been made or taken. I assume the appeal that you're referring to now is that you somehow qualify for the waiver that's provided for in the legislative language that addresses the TPA.
That's correct. It deals with whether or not the principal was at fault in creating the condition, the gravity of the violation, and the prior opportunity to remedy this condition.
Well, when Mr. I think it's Fedita was here last, we told him, or we looked at the language addressing appeals found in section 2.111, parens C, parens 8A.
Right.
Which addresses these appeals.
Yeah, and then 1, 2, 3, and subparen 1, 2, 3, and 4.
And it says the waiver may only be granted, and you're seeking a waiver. And as I understand it, it says the waiver may only be granted for just cause based on the following considerations. Where the applicant's an individual, the fault of the applicant creating the condition that led to the order. Where the applicant's a corporation, limited liability company, or similar business firm. The fault of the firm's principals in creating the condition that led to the order. Number three, the gravity of the violation. And number four, any prior opportunity which the applicant, and where the applicant is a business firm, the applicant's principals had to remedy the condition. And then it goes on to say, a waiver may be conditioned upon compliance with additional requirements determined to be helpful or necessary to maintain public health, safety, and welfare. And it also goes on to say there shall be no variances or waivers to the requirements of paragraph 211C8, except as provided in C8A. So with that having been said,
Ms. McKelvey, that I think you were reading the, and they're pretty much very similar, but you were reading the section as relates to master planning.
Right.
As to master plan, and that's
on this one. Is the verbiage the same when it comes to?
As to the criteria, it is.
Okay.
Everything else was, there's some difference in the other language. The TPA section is actually section 2D3.
I'm talking about Article 17, Section 2D3.
Yes, sir. 2.111D3.
It's I think it's about the same.
Looks virtually identical, yeah. Except for leaving off the proviso that says you can't stray from the other rule, or from the above, or whatever. Anyway, the point I was going to make was, when we were here last, I suggested that Mr. Fedita focus his attention on the element, if you will, that goes to the gravity of the violation. And then we had a discussion here. I questioned whether or not gravity of the violation would take into consideration the financial impact he kept complaining of, albeit very generally, and told him he might want to come back and be prepared to present specifics.
I am prepared
for that. Having said that, then the city said, well, we don't know that the financial impact comes into play at all when it comes to the gravity of the violation. So, that's the lay of the land.
May I approach?
Yes, sir. Okay. What am I looking at?
Documentation related to the financial impact. And what's before you is a schedule I've prepared, and this deals with financial records that are maintained during the special events in 2011 and 2012. And during, like for instance, during 2011, during Race Week, which was this February 16th, 24th, the credit card sales alone there were $16,018.52. And appended behind this are the merchant billing statements that are highlighted for the various months. And bike weeks from March 9th to March 18th was $17,467.43 in that period, just credit card sales. And July 4th, that period was in excess of $8,000. Bike Oktoberfest was $41,544.74. And you also have this P&Ls comparing 2011-2012 in that package, and shows what the monthly sales were for that same period of time. In 2011, comparing the two, the special event sales were 37% of the gross sales for those 4 months. And extrapolating that in 2011, for instance, the TPA revenue was 20% of my client's total revenue for the year, just for those periods of time. So from his perspective, I mean, not being able to operate under a TPA would result in financial devastation. And I've also attached his 2011 front page of his 1120, showing the gross revenue for that year. You see, in 2012, and using the same criteria for the special events as compared to his P&L by month, it was actually greater. The TPA revenue was 45% of his gross sales for those 4 months, which are arguably the biggest months of the year. But approximately, I can represent that with those 4 months total, 113, 182, 70, is probably about 50% of his gross revenue for the year. I'm not prepared to address other matters related to the gravity of the violation as well, when you're ready.
So according to my math, if I'm adding up the days correctly, what you're saying is, using 2011 as an example, so I don't have a 2012 return yet, I wouldn't necessarily expect it to be done. You're saying that if you add up these days, 7% of the year translates into an excess of 20% of his income.
That's correct. And, you know, this, I don't think it's beyond the pale to represent this economy. That's essentially a pass or fail number. You're either going to make it or you're not. I mean, losing that much revenue in a single year would essentially put him out of business.
But at the same time, your argument is presupposing that absent the TPA, he'd have no business at all.
Well, I think he would. I can't say he would have no business, but I would think that the business would be substantially down. I mean, during the TPA periods, the vendors are vending out on the street, essentially.
All right, well, let me ask one other question. And again, for better or worse, I keep focusing on this gravity of the violation.
Well, the gravity of the violation...
the reason I focus on that is, if I'm not mistaken, he was told the day before to put these materials inside, and the city came back the next day and they were still there. Am I correct in that,
no, sir?
I saw some photographs.
Yeah, the photograph was from 2010. It was issued a handwritten violation 6/12/2010. A verbal violation 4/10 of 2012. He also was issued a violation 2/12/09 from the EPA, and then of course 11/10.
Okay. I got a photograph here of 11/10/12 that was provided in this packet.
I should get three photographs, yeah. And then there's a fourth
one in 2009. And then, as I understand it, he was notified on the 10th he was to remove these articles.
My client wasn't even there that day.
And a second. And then I thought I had a photograph on the 11th. Guess I'm mistaken. No. All three photographs on the 10th?
I think they're all on the same day.
There's another 10th, there's one from 2008, it was.
The ones I have are all three dated 11/10/12.
I guess that's my mistake. I thought there was one of them.
Well, what I was showing him is the same violation was brought on the same employee cyclist on June 12, 2010, and same violation again 11/10/2012. So 2 years over, same person was the direct employee manager out there.
Well, I'm just here on the 11/10 violation, as I understand it.
Which you had a will find in place.
Right.
For previous violations. Okay. And then the last thing, if you want to be heard on it, because I don't really understand it myself, is I don't see that requirement here, so that falls in the other section.
Well, I'd like to address the gravity.
All right, go right in.
Okay. This is a shirt rack that was outside. My client was not there that day. He doesn't work on weekends. He wasn't given any opportunity to cure it before being cited. I can't have my client testify about how the rack came to be outside. I'm not sure if that came out in the initial hearing or not. But this is a movable clothing rack that was actually being taken to another location. And the person who was supposed to pick it up hadn't... The rack went outside before the person came to get it. It wasn't intended to remain outside. Rather, it was supposed to go down the street. I can have my client address that if the court likes.
Which customer? Is it your contention that the financial impact somehow falls into consideration of gravity of the violation?
Yes.
How so?
Well, the it wasn't during a special event. So he's being penalized for something that, you know, didn't occur during that. I think that the gravity of the violation is to remove his ability to have a TPA, given the gravity of the violation, generates a tremendous financial impact on him, because when you look at the gravity of the violation, it's not a permanent structure, and we're all familiar about the stuff that's happened on Main Street. It was merely a clothing rack. And to be able to suffer a loss in revenue that's so significant by having a clothing rack temporarily outside when it wasn't even supposed to be moved down the street, is punitive in nature. So I think because of that, to sanction him for a violation of, well, I can't say it's of great gravity, but of lesser gravity, is punitive in nature. So I think that probably these financial records are related to determining if this penalty is sufficient as to the gravity of, as to the violation, if this punishment that's being imposed is commensurate with the violation that he committed, which was merely having a clothing rack outside. It wasn't something where he was told to put it away and didn't. Imagine the clothing rack went back inside as soon as the city official told the employee to get it off the street. So for him to lose all these TPA events until 2016 based on this violation is excessive.
Okay, anything else?
No.
I think your attorney's covered the points that I'm interested in. I mean, I don't want to preempt anybody from having their say. If somebody wants to come up and speak, by all means, speak. All right, let's say the city.
Mr. Verkelter. Anthony Jackson for the record. I know you specifically asked about the gravity of the violation. I do want to point, and I'm sure you're aware of this, but I just like to point it for the record that in addition to that, we're also looking at the fault of the applicant in creating the condition that led to the order, that being the order of noncompliance. The inspector informed the magistrate at that hearing that the applicant had been told previous times about outside displays. And even in this situation, although he says it was incident on and not intended for sales, if we look at these pictures, the pictures have the appearance of customers making purchases, as well as signage that says, if you look up on the right-hand corner, bike T-shirts, consistent with what the activity that we see. So when we ask about the fault seems to be pretty clear that as it relates to the applicants and the resulting order, that being the order of noncompliance. And then, as you said, the real next principal question is that of the gravity of the violation. And you asked us to look at and at least be prepared to speak to the issue of financial impact. The position of the city is that, and it's a position that I expressed preliminarily, and that's that financial impact would not be a proper evaluation of the gravity of the violation. And for a number of reasons. It starts with just the whole general thought that Mr. Foster said this is punitive. Well, it's an effort to deter an activity that the city decided it doesn't want to occur. And so because
what
of...
What activity is that?
That's the activity of doing outside sales,
well,
outside
activity. That you're talking about includes the whole panoply of ordinance violations that the city has that go from very, very minor things to extremely major life safety issues.
Well, let me say it with a little bit more clarity.
You say it's intended to curb the very activity that we're talking about. I know ultimately that brings us to the gravity of the violation, but I'm going to tell you right now what my problem is. Okay? We have life safety issues that come before the special magistrate all the time. The largest fine that we have ever meted out that I can recall does not come close to the financial impact. Some of these people, I'm not prejudging anything yet. Some of these people may be subjected to if the financials corroborate their claim regarding the financial hardship. We have people that disable smoke alarms. We have dirty pools that people ignore with impunity. And what do? We fine them $250 a day, usually, the maximum. Okay? I think one of the largest fines I can remember in however many years I've been doing this was $15,000. I think one other time against an apartment complex, there might have been a fine of as much as $25,000. And to me, this legislation has a huge chasm between saying that if you're found in noncompliance, you're disqualified for 3 years. And the chasm being you could be disqualified for a very minor code violation. And then the financial consequences are going to be devastating. And I'll be honest with you right now, I'll say something else. I don't find having this rack out there, and maybe I'm tipping my hand, but as far as I'm concerned, I consider it letting you people know where I'm coming from so you can be sure that everyone leaves here, they know they've addressed every consideration that had to be addressed. I don't consider that as egregious as leaving an open, dirty pool out there where children can reach it. And yet we would fine that property owner $250 a day. I don't find this as egregious as apartment owners who disable smoke detectors. Yet we would also similarly fine that person $250 a day until it was brought into compliance. And those fines are well earned. And perhaps they should be a lot more, to be honest with you, when you consider as egregious as they are. Now we're looking at the other end of the spectrum here, where you have a financial impact that's greater than anything we've ever meted out in the way of punishment for violations that could be extremely egregious and serious and may very well warrant, you know, crippling someone financially for 3 years, or a violation that may be very minor. And it's that chasm that I'm trying to explore to understand, because counsel hit on one point. The question in my mind is whether this sort of punishment is punitive. But before I even get there, the question becomes, when it says the gravity of the violation, my knee-jerk reaction to that is to say, well, if the violation's minor and the financial punishment is excessive, then that's something I should be taking into consideration. But what you're saying is, no, the financial impact is irrelevant. If he's found in noncompliance for anything, no matter how minor it may be, this is the punishment. He knew it when he signed up. Those are the rules.
Understand. I think you make a very good point, and it's not a point that we disagree with, and that's the question of the how minor versus how major the violation itself is. I would take the position that the gravity of the violation is an evaluation that's done by an independent magistrate who looks at that violation and determines how substantial or how major, how minor in the general scheme of things. I think the question or the decision, and decision's not a fair statement, the conclusion that the financial impact is the answer to knowing how substantial, how major the event is. In this situation, is not a fair evaluation, and here's why. Anyone, any business, especially during the special event period, will be impacted financially. We understand that. There's no argument that they won't have a financial impact. That's a result. The penalty that was imposed by the magistrate was not a penalty, a monetary penalty. However, as we all know, there was a substantial residual effect, and that's what we're really dealing with, the substantial residual effect. In our opinion, the position of the role of the magistrate is as an independent magistrate reviewing now, not whether or not the person D was in violation of a code. We realize you already made that decision. But it's also not reviewing whether or not it's a good legislative act of the commission to create a residual effect that's of great serious impact. Having personally looked back at the minutes of some of the prior commission meetings during the bike week events, the discussions of the commission is one discussion that says first, they look at the right to, and we're talking about bike week, although this is a TPA, so as we, let me just make sure I make that distinction clear. Because we're talking about a TPA, this is what we're really talking about is allowing a business 20 days of the year to be able to have outside activity. Now, understanding that a business that's in the general bike week sector will probably utilize that round of bike week period, but it's not specific to bike week events, so it's not in that regard within the master plan. But nevertheless, the discussions were discussions of, one, recognizing that this authorization is a gratuitous authorization. It's not required. But it is across-the-board spread to businesses at large that qualify. And there's a strong recognition that businesses that, and I'll put it in quotes, that are presumed to perceive to cheat or to do stuff that they're not allowed to do, get a special or a certain advantage over businesses that aren't. If businesses go out 25 days instead of 20 days, that's an advantage that other businesses don't have. And so the extra opportunity to hawk the wares outside of the business doors is a opportunity that the city did not want businesses to take advantage of and do not want businesses to take advantage of. So they've imposed a penalty as a result of businesses that are not participating in the manner in which they would desire for the businesses in our city to participate with outside activity.
It didn't occur during a special event.
And it's not required to because it's a TPA.
This violation goes to, or this penalty goes to anything that could occur all year long. All it needs is a notice of noncompliance or a finding of noncompliance.
And that's correct, Mr. Vakalji, but in this situation, interestingly enough, This violation is a violation specifically related to the types of violations that they're trying to prohibit. It didn't have to be. You're absolutely right. It could have been that he was doing something different. And I don't know if that's correct because I saw it from different language.
And if this were a different setting and the city were here looking for a fine for violation of a will fine, we would probably be telling the gentleman he's going to pay $250 to $500 for having violated that will fine. And then the next time he comes back, it'll be progressive, and it'll probably be $1,000. That's the ordinary will fine scenario that you and I are well aware of.
Okay, that's correct.
We're out of that. We're out of the will fine scenario. Now we're saying there's going to be an extra punishment meted out here.
And even with
you're found in noncompliance, you're not going to get to participate for 3 years. You're not going to get a TPA. And that's fine. That's the city commission's prerogative. They're the elected folks, not me. But the statute says I'm to consider the gravity of the violation.
And I agree. But
and the gravity of the violation here is, okay, he put wares outside. He wasn't supposed to. He had a will fine, so he can't claim he didn't know he wasn't supposed to do that. My sister panel found him in noncompliance, entered an order of will fine, and I fully intend to give full faith and credit to that work. I'm not going to hear any conversation about how he didn't mean to, or it was an accident, or it was a visiting manager. That doesn't matter. It's a violation as far as I'm concerned. So we're here, clearly,
on a violation and going forward, what is its impact, and specifically as it pertains to his eligibility for these TPAs, and again, the laxity, if you will, and I hesitate to even call it that, is just this language that says I'm to consider the gravity of the violation vis-a-vis this three-year ban. And I guess what you're saying is he was on notice. He was supposed to comply with everything. He didn't comply with everything. He was found in noncompliance. Under the language, the gravity of the violation is egregious as far as we're concerned because he violated an outstanding will-fine order. In other words, he had been told before not to do this. He did it anyway. And with that, he was found in violation of his will-fine order, and consequently, we consider it to be a very grave violation that would warrant this three-year ban if one were to assume I'm supposed to take into consideration the financial impact. Although I understand your position is I don't take into consideration the financial impact.
I just don't know how you can do that fairly and evenly against businesses. The degree of advantage over the business, I think, would be a looking at finances when you're looking at the relative finances of the other businesses around him. The impact of on its effect to the community and how is it impacting the community, the city's business district, and the efforts of the city to curb or control certain activities in their business district, the level of deterrence that such activity and such penalty is imposing. I think those are those weights of gravity that I think would be the more appropriate gravity. When we look at the sales, we're presupposing that there's no sales at all on the days when we're presupposing there's no sales at all if he's not utilizing outside sales, and that's not a fair conclusion. Many businesses, especially during the bike week period, many businesses have activities going on outside and inside. And in this situation, we're talking about a retail business, so the only activity going on outside, it's not entertainment, it's not anything other than selling the same equipment or material that's being sold inside the business. So the significance of that impact may not be as great as the numbers that you're left to look at would show. Let me see if, I don't know if staff has any other, but if I can have this moment. But I guess for all those reasons, we just don't believe financial impact, recognizing that financial impact absolutely will affect any business that's not operating, especially during this situation, as we're talking about TPAs, it doesn't have to be during the bike week period. It can be any period. But financial impact will always be a factor.
Let me ask you a couple more questions. Article 17, conditions and requirements for specific uses. 3, temporary promotional activities. 3A3, the gravity of the violation. Okay, so under this legislative scheme, what if I conclude that the gravity of the violation is minor? Under this legislative scheme, what is my discretion?
I believe it is your discretion.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. We'll assume if I considered it to be an extremely grave violation, then it absolutely warrants a three-year ban. I understand that part. Now, what if I consider the violation to be relatively minor? And the violation we're talking about, of course, is now the violation of the existing will-fine order.
Understand. Specifically, now we're talking specifically about temporary permit TPAs, which, as we said before, are 20-day opportunity for 20 days in a year to utilize. Well, you can lessen that time. You can say, well, instead of 3 years, I believe 1 year would be sufficient in this situation.
This is confused to me because I don't see this in here. This is why I'm asking these questions.
And that's our perspective, and I think that's a fair interpretation of the application of the ordinance, that in your discretion, as you look and you weigh the factors that you're weighing, you, and I think ultimately, and it may not be here, maybe in the other one, but I think the way that I read and what can read in the other one, and I'd have to flip to it, that you ultimately have that discretion to make the decision on the time and the impact, or to, I think it says somewhere that you can create alternative sanctions or effects. If I,
well, it said it under the other statute, but you redirected me back over here to the TPA statute.
I understand.
So the statute had language in there to the effect that I had some discretion, if you will, to try to impose conditions or restrictions that would somehow implement the law while basically still imposing some kind of sanction. And
well,
I'm referring to Section 2. Article 17, Section 2.111C8B. It says, this is the other statute, outside activities and uses, that mirrors the very language we've been discussing, except it goes on to have a B, which reads, a waiver may be conditioned upon compliance with additional requirements determined to be helpful or necessary in maintaining public health, safety, and welfare. Now, I don't really know what that means, but it sounds as though it's trying to interject some sort of latitude. But here again, that's not in the provision that you're directing me to.
I understand, and but I'm nevertheless left with looking to this provision as we speak to TPAs, because the provision that I reference is the one that speaks specifically to TPAs. However, the provisions in general are outside activities. And let me speak just briefly with my staff on that.
Because it's important that we go through this.
Mr. Kelch, I believe I'd have to concede, and not that it's a negative concession, but I'd have to concede that I don't see in that second section anything that specifically spells out this latitude. However, it is the interpretation of staff that latitude is the latitude that's intended and the way it should be applied. And I agree, looking at it in total, in this section 2.111, as you said, every other aspect of this section is pretty much reflects duplication, and that's an area where it's not stated, but there's no reason not to imply or anticipate the authority or the latitude of the magistrate to make decisions in lessening as they go into a weighing factor. I think, as you have said before, it's obvious that there's an intent for there to be some type of weighing and some conclusions to be drawn based upon that weighing. And the conclusions that I would represent is that as that weighing is done, that it's not a all or nothing, or even that perspective of what, which we've exercised before of coming back every year. It's not necessarily that it's saying it has to be done, but instead that the magistrate would have the authority to make adjustments based upon the determinations being made by the magistrate.
Why are we not dealing under Section 2.111?
We are under Section 2.111, but instead of being your original initial reference was to Section C8, and when we start talking about TPAs, that reference moves over to Section D3. That's just a different category of outside activities.
Okay, we are dealing with Section 2.11. Okay.
So you believe that's the intent?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No, no, it's not written yet. Which is wrong. Okay. Mr. Kelly, in having and I know you're looking for something, so I'll wait a moment.
I'm looking at Section 2.111, A, B, C, A, A, all right, whatever. That's on page 16. Whatever. Then I go to page 7. Then I go to page 8. Then I go to page 19. Now we've got D, which goes on to further describe temporary promotional activities. Shall be permitted outside of provided.
Same code, just the different
sections. It's not just the same code, it's the same section, is
right.
It not?
Right, yes. But this part,
so this is a later part of the same section.
Right.
And the section you're directing me to incorporates 2.111. So in looking at this, what I call the enabling legislation, I have 2.111C that talks about outside activities, C8 that talks about the City Commission authorizing temporary outside activities, 8A talking about the 3-year ban, 8A1234 talking about the conditions that would constitute just cause to be taken into consideration with regard to waiver. And then I have B under there that says a waiver may be conditioned upon compliance with additional requirements determined to be helpful or necessary in maintaining public health, safety, and welfare. So that would seem to give perhaps a little more discretion when it comes to talking about fashioning a penalty that may be more appropriate. Then we have section, we go on to sections 9, A, B, C, D, outside activities. Then we go all the way to section D, additional outside activities and uses, and under that, we start talking about the TPAs again. So we're talking about the same law here, no matter what language we're addressing, are we not?
Well, there is a distinction, Mr. Bukeljan. That distinction is under subsection 8. We're talking about temporary outside activity that's authorized by the commission, that being the master plan. Whereas, as we go forward, when we go from 8 to 9, then we're talking about when we get to, let me make sure I'm on the right page. When we get over to subsection 3 under subsection, D3, we're then talking about temporary promotional activities, and that's pursuant to the code. And permit issuance.
Just looking at the title, C addresses outside activities and uses specifically permitted. D talks about conditional outside activities and uses. So I assume there must be some variation there. And you're telling me we're functioning under D.
That's correct.
And under D, we don't have that additional provision.
That's correct. I agree with you, Mr. Couch. I don't see it.
We don't have that subsection B saying the waiver may be conditioned upon compliance with additional requirements. Which brings us back to the gravity of the violation.
And I do want to just correct something I said previously in talking with city staff. The position was not as clear. Under that section, the city staff's position is not that you have latitude. As we look at that section, the position of the city staff is that subsection A was written through a commission authorization. Subsection C and subsection D was written through a permitting authorization, and that there is no latitude as to it's an all or nothing perspective, at least of the city staff.
And then the question I come back to once again, what if I find the gravity of the violation to be minor? What then? No ban at all?
That would be the way, Mr. Kelcher.
You're telling me it's an all or nothing thing. So, and it says I'm to consider the gravity of the violation. So if I consider the gravity of the violation.
As to the effects on temporary permits under subsection B, that's the interpretation of the code from staff. That's yes, sir. That it's all or nothing. So if indeed you find minor and you feel that it's so minor that this that no sanction is appropriate, then that's if you indeed agree with the perspective of staff, Your Honor.
So it's the city's contention that the provision we're dealing with is 211D3.
Yes.
And that confines today's discussions to items 1, 2, 3, and 4, given the respondent's application for a waiver. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Anyone else want to be heard on this matter?
John Nicholson, 413 North Grandview Avenue.
Can you raise your hand, please? Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you provide is the truth, and the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
And I'm sorry, your name again?
John Nicholson. I live in the area. I walk past this 365 days a year, basically, or drive past. I'm speaking for residents, people that live there. I know it seems like it's minor, but over the last 10 or 20 years, you add up the minor, and you're talking several hundred times he's broken this, all right? I know about 30 people have t-shirt shops, gift shops, et cetera, that are not breaking the law, that are surviving by obeying the law. And what does it say to them that it's okay for this person to constantly thumb his nose at the city and at them, that he can constantly break the law and it doesn't matter? I know there's a will fine, and sorry, Colleen, they're not there 7 days a week. They're Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, and Friday night the stuff comes out. It's there for Saturday and Sunday, and then it goes back in. he's supposed to have 20 days. He has 23, 24 days between Bike Week and Biketoberfest. So anytime he does it, those other five or six times a year are gratis. He says it's a hardship on him. I don't think it's a hardship on him. There have only been three tents that I know of. His shop across the street, the 22,000, and then in an alleyway right off of Main Street. Those are the only three tents. The alley doesn't do it anymore because they would put all their garbage in the city parking lot, and they were told not to, so they don't vent anymore. The 22,000, I believe most of the time vends, but they don't always. Of those 30 shops on A1A, they're surviving. I'm guessing that he will get a financial hit, but not as serious as he says it is. Because the people are walking past his shop, if he has the stuff, they will come in, and there will be an amount of money that they make. There is a portion that he makes extra, but he makes that extra year-round that the other people are not making. So I'm asking you to look at the financials clearly. It's not it's a lot of money per se, but it's not. The other people are surviving. It's more important that he follow the law. I know he's had other businesses, I'm presuming, because I see him at them, that if he can do it three or four locations, what does it say to everybody else that he's constantly allowed to break the law and there's no ramification? Thank you.
Okay. Anything more from the applicant? Anything more from the city?
Nothing further from the city. All right. Well, it is what it is. Section 2.111C addresses outside activities and uses specifically permitted. It goes on to say the following uses and activities shall be permitted outside where the use is permitted in the district. It has a subsection dealing with temporary outside activities. It also has penalties for violation. It also has grounds for waiver, and it specifies the grounds for waiver. And it even goes on to say that a waiver could be conditioned upon compliance with additional requirements determined to be helpful or necessary in maintaining public health, safety, and welfare. We go further on down to section 9. We go further down to section D,
This is addresses conditional outside activities and uses. It says the following, and it goes on to say, the following uses shall be permitted outside where the use is permitted in the district, provided the conditions set forth for the use are met. It goes on to have its own discussion regarding temporary promotional activities, its own ban or a finding of noncompliance, its own allowance of an application for waiver, and its own criteria for the determination of just cause for a waiver. Absent from this section is any suggestion, as is found earlier, that the magistrate can condition a waiver of noncompliance with additional requirements. That is noticeably absent from the provision that everyone seems to be in agreement that we're proceeding under. That being the case, I'm confined to the four criteria that I have there. I have, we're dealing with a corporation which satisfies items 1 and 2. More importantly, this was a violation of a will fine. So by its very definition, the applicant had a prior opportunity to remedy the condition because he was on notice that it wasn't to happen again. Then I'm left with the gravity of the violation. The gravity of the violation is a violation of a will fine. I do consider that grave. Therefore, the waiver is denied. Did you want to be heard any further on it?
I just want to say, we didn't have a will fine until this. This is what put me in a will fine. We didn't have a will fine before.
The will fine order is in place. I'm not going back to question whatever preceded. And I guess I'll keep my personal comments to myself. But as far as the legislative act, as it's written, and the criteria that I'm to take into consideration, as I understand it, waiver is denied.
And can we address the gravity some more, or are you done with that issue?
I think I'm done with that issue.
Then what about number two, the fault of the firm's principal in creating the condition? My client wasn't even there that day.
Your client is a corporation, and he was on notice that he was on notice that this activity wasn't permitted, so that's a gnosis.
So it's taking money away from my kids, from my family. I mean, it's for three
I didn't draft this legislation, and if this were a political forum, I'd tell you what I thought of it, but it's not.
Okay, but you have the
so
right to waive that.
No, I don't. The only right I have is to determine whether you created the condition, the gravity of the violation, and any prior opportunity you had to remedy the condition.
Well, the gravity of this violation was merely a shirt rack outside for a short time. I mean, you went down the list of things that you believe were far more egregious, and I didn't think that this came anywhere close to that.
Stop 1 second.
I can hardly take a salary.
Okay, let me back up. The will fine that I'm dealing with here was issued as a result of this same violation?
Yes.
Yes.
I thought this was a pending or existing will fine that was subsequently violated.
No, this dealt with what just happened last month.
No. He was previously noticed by the inspector, but no, there was no will fine previously noticed.
No. Okay, so he's not in violation of the will fine.
No, he's not.
Okay, this came from the Code Enforcement Board, and I guess I should have looked at what the Code Enforcement Board did with this. So the violation that you cited him for in November culminated in a combination finding of noncompliance and order of will fine all in one?
Yes.
So he hasn't violated the will fine.
No, he hasn't.
No, he hasn't.
Everybody sit down. All right. My thought all along was that was there was a will find order in place when he violated. So that having been clarified, what we're dealing with here is an initial violation for having outside activity.
Initial violation in terms of a finding from the magistrate, that's or from the board. That's correct.
Okay, and so he was found in noncompliance by the code enforcement board. Code enforcement board at that time specifically December 19 of 2012 then determined it was going to impose an order of will find.
That's correct.
Okay. So there was no previous will find order in place that he violated.
That's correct.
So then the question to be properly presented is whether his putting these goods out there, being cited because he was in non-compliance, I presume he was ultimately found to be in compliance, but then the board issued a will fine order. The question is whether the gravity of that violation, what? Warrants a 3-year ban?
Yeah, I guess that's the only way you can weigh it, whether that the gravity is significant enough to, I can't say it that way, whether it warrants or not. I can say that it's a measure of how grave is it, how significant is it in relationship to the things that you're going to weigh and consider for determining whether or not you give a waiver. Whether it's the gravity lies in such a posture that a waiver would be appropriate in this situation.
And as far as this respondent is concerned, this is the first time he was cited?
No.
We need you here, please.
It was cited before. This is the first time it was taken to the code board, and we had a will find. So actually, like I said, before the business, he said he
believed that. He told me he opened the business in 09. That's when we first cited him, was 212-09, 612-10, 410-12, and, of course, 11-10-12. But this was actually the first time we took him to code board. I got a will find on it.
Okay, Mr. City Attorney, I just can't seem to get away from this. Try telling me one more time what's meant by the gravity of the violation. I mean, we have a whole panoply of violations out there, from the very, very minor to the very, very serious. So, what is meant by gravity, and what is my discretion once I make a determination regarding how grave it is?
Mr. McKelch, I believe that the gravity of the violation is a relative term, and it's unfortunately one of those somewhat discretionary. It's one that we utilize for even general code violations. That's part of the criteria for the fines that are imposed pursuant to 162. So it's a similar language, and it's the question of how grave, in the whole scheme of things, is the violation. As you look at your overall criteria for sanctioning, when we're looking at it from a magistrate penalty perspective. Here we're looking at it from the perspective of now we have a separate legislative act that has residual effect once a finding has been made. And so the finding of noncompliance has been made, even if he was already sanctioned under the criteria and fines pursuant to the code violation itself, this is a separate residual effect, that being the process of not issuing permits if they're in a certain posture. That posture is not just not having a code violation. There are other things that create the posture of not being permitted to or authorized to receive a permit. And so as long as those conditions exist, then a permit is not issued unless the waiver is granted. So what your latitude becomes once you've made a determination, as you've looked at the condition that's prohibiting him from getting temporary permits under our code, and the provision that's been provided is now a weight of how only thing I can put to grave is to say substantial. So how substantial in the overall scheme of the totality of it all, how substantial is this violation? As you weigh that now, and I can't see any way to weigh it other than by its overall ultimate impact.
What is a grave violation? Give me an example of a grave violation under our code.
I'd have to do it more from, again, relative. If we were talking about a residential home, I agree with the statement you said previously that an unsupervised pool, recognizing the impact and the effect of what could happen with that pool being unsupervised in that residential area, I would deem that to be grave. I would deem that to be of substantial nature and of substantial concern. We made arguments on why we believe that having outside sales create a degree of substantial concern may not be as substantial as, well, I don't even know what to compare it to, because we're talking about sales. If it was activity, we may say it may not be as substantial as someone making loud noises against neighbors, but we're talking about sales. So the only thing that I can see that would make a determination of its relevance would be some of the things I mentioned before, that that unfair advantage over the other businesses and the impact to a process or a plan that's been put forth, a procedure that's been laid forth by the commission that's discretionary, and that they've elected to provide an opportunity for businesses and an effort for deterrence to keep businesses from overreaching or exceeding that which has been laid forth as their plan. There's been a restriction that's been put in place and an opportunity for consideration of circumstances that would make this something that should not be attached to them, that being the 3-year ban. So now you're left weighing these circumstances. And when I say it's not fair to consider financial, from a relative perspective, I understand it's everything. But from a specific perspective, I don't know how we can evenly and fairly weigh or even expect that there wouldn't be a financial impact if someone's not participating at any period throughout the year, not only on our special event period, but any period, if they're able to do something more than what their general permit allows. And that's the whole reason they would seek this additional authorization, so that they have the opportunity or the hope of doing a little better than they would otherwise do. So the financial impact is one that's anticipated. It's not desired, but yeah, it will have one. How substantial, I don't know if that's measurable at this point.
Okay, and the applicant that we're dealing with here is Trent Charlie Fedita. Is that the applicant?
Yes.
Pardon me, you have a lot of discretion in assigning definition to the word rate for gravity. The job here is to determine how egregious the violation is. And the saving clause, or what they talk about it in the initial one that we're not considering, and I think on the beginning of 2.111, is ways to come up with dealing with issues of safety, health, welfare. And I'd argue that the clothing rack is probably on the low end of that. Examples you cited, such as disabling smoke detectors or dirty pools, directly impact those things. Safety, health, welfare. I think looking at it overall and determining the weight that you want to assign to the violation, that it's not a grave violation, rather a minor violation.
Well, as I struggle to understand it still, the fact of the matter is we're dealing with a business area here, so we're not really focusing on whether kids are going to drown there, and we're usually not, anyway, there might not be the life safety issues. And I assume there are appearance considerations here, too. So it's a different context in which we're trying to determine gravity. I guess we're trying to determine how grave a violation it is, given that we're talking about business dealings and compliance with these business ordinances that may not necessarily address life safety issues, but they do address appearance standards, competition, how things are to be taken, how business is to be conducted. And the gravity, I guess, that we're talking about is in that context. So it's probably unfair that I compare it to a swimming pool or a smoke detector.
Mr. Kelcher, if I can't say, I'm sorry.
As usual, I'm wrestling with, quite frankly, what is a pretty severe sanction for what could be a relatively minor violation. But here again, I'm still coming back to this language, and my concerns are that, as pointed out by counsel, that the discretion in this instance is limited. And so,
Mr. Couch, if I can point to one thing.
I guess if I determine the gravity of the violation to be relatively significant, which of course I'm using words now that aren't in here, if I consider the gravity relatively significant, then I guess I'm supposed to deny the waiver. If I determine the gravity to be relatively minor, I guess that's a basis upon which I can grant the waiver. Does that sound about right? As we're wrestling to understand this language, because it's really not my place to start interjecting and interpreting, and it is my intent to try to enforce.
Yes, I think there's just one point I did leave out, and that's that I think part of that weight should go back to looking at, I think Mr. Foster may have been right in his perspective, they're looking at subsection A and B, since that's a general, and that's just talking about the purpose general intent or application of outside activity from the perspective of the legislature and the code. One, laying out the purpose, and then B, saying that in general it's prohibited and basically lays out a basis for the prohibitions.
Even though it isn't a business district, I think in the overall scheme, the sign rack outside, which is pretty arguably there a short time, in the overall list of horribles that could be raised, is on the low end.
I would tend to agree, but in the context of these provisions, it basically says there isn't supposed to be any outside activity. So, sticking your stuff outside, while it may be taken for granted, and it may be tawdry, and heaven knows it's universal, is prohibited. And so in the context of this act,
well, that would mean that everything
it flies in the face of the innate, the very definition of why this law is there.
Right, but that logic, then everything would be a grave violation. but you'd have no discretion. And I think the word gravity implies that you do.
The word gravity implies something, and I'm supposed to give it some definition. Well, I'm supposed to enforce it. I'm not quite sure what it means. I was under the impression that it would encompass financial hardship resulting from denial of a waiver. The city's position is, no, that doesn't have anything to do with it. It has to do with the nature of the violation itself. Okay, what if I find it to be a minor violation? What if I find it to be a major violation? Okay, we're all in agreement, then you're denied a waiver if it's a major violation. Is this a major violation? The law says right at the outset, you're supposed to be conducting all your activities inside. You're only conducting outside activities under these specific guidelines. And everyone in the Main Street area has to know that by now. So, does that make it a major violation that he's putting his goods outside to be sold? Now, if this provision had the latitude the other one did, where I could fashion something that I would consider to be equitable, then we'd be out of here already. But it doesn't. It has this, I'm not going to characterize it, it's just, let's just say it has this 3-year ban. And this gentleman's provided me financials saying that ban's significant. And I've done this long enough to know that even if this was a violation of the will fine, which I mistakenly thought it was for the first half of this proceeding, we'd probably fine him $500 and send him on his way and tell him next time he comes back it'll be $1,000. And the next time after that it'll be $2,000. That's the way we would do that. Because that's the way we typically handle it. But we're dealing with this special legislation serving this particular purpose. And trying to understand the language.
Can I say something, sir? I know I
sure
submitted in financial and all this. I just want to say, whatever your decision is, your decision, the impact that is going to create on me and on the business and on my family is huge.
Okay.
Compared
to, yeah, I heard you say that once before.
You know, be this a will find him the violation, go down to subparagraph 4, he didn't have a prior opportunity to remedy it. He's being sanctioned, he's lost his TPA.
Okay. All right. All right, I'm granting the waiver.
Thank you.
Now, let me say something here. There's a will fine in place now. Okay? If that will fine is violated, that will satisfy my gravity of the violation requirement, as far as I'm concerned. Because that's a knowing violation. You know, I know the city, well, in any event. So, I'm granting the waiver, but you're on notice with regard to the will fine. Okay, thank you.
Sir. Good morning, Mr. Kelcher. I'm Jim Morris. I'm here on behalf of Mikey's Love Bar. As noted in the clerk's announcement, this case number 2 on your agenda. Case 2 and 3 are, rather 1 and 2 are very, very similar. The folks in 1 permitted me to go ahead and I thank them for that. The issue before you in this particular case is the application of the Bike Week Master Plan guidelines. It's an administrative set of guidelines, and it is used first by a screening committee to screen applications for activities, in this case, during Bike Week. The same process applies during Biketoberfest. One of the requirements, and they're set out at the beginning of the Bike Week Master Plan guidelines, is a business which has been open and operating for a minimum of 250 days, 6 hours per day, during the 1-year period immediately preceding the application date, or a business which opens and operates in a new structure for which the CO was first issued during the one-year period immediately preceding the application date. So a permanent business in an existing structure has to be 250 days of the year in advance of the application deadline. A business which simply receives a new CO isn't subject to the same 250-day requirement. In this particular case, my clients were not open 250 days prior to the application deadline, which is a threshold of the administrative proceeding. And the, as you know, I think by now, the guidelines do permit a waiver by your office, depending upon application of the criteria. And the criteria are set out in Section 9 of the Bike Week Master Plan guidelines. They may be very similar to the ones that you were just working with, but I do want to go through Section 9, which is appeals. And it, appeals is set up that an applicant must submit an application timely, i.e. by the deadline for the Bike Week Master Plan. And they may appeal if they are denied. And the special magistrate is granted the power to waive compliance with a provision and grant participation upon a determination that just cause exists for the noncompliance. In determining whether just cause exists, the special magistrate shall consider whether the applicant is an individual, in this case it's a corporation, whether the applicant is a corporation, limited liability company, etc., the fault of the firm's principals in creating the condition. In this instance, we're talking about time, not an event of any degree of fault. It's just when they opened the business that is the circumstance. The next is the gravity of the violation. There is no violation whatsoever in existence here. And then any prior opportunity that the applicant had to remedy the condition. And again, we're talking about the passage of time. From the standpoint of the purpose of the ordinance that created the guidelines, it was created when Bike Week on Main Street basically capsulized Main Street to only be a special events period. And the City Commission created the standard to encourage full year-round business on Main Street so that Main Street would have a more viable commercial life throughout the balance of the year. The client in this case opened a business in the early part of October. It's a continuing, ongoing business. They opened in an existing premise, so the business had previously been, or property rather, had previously been CO'd. So it doesn't fall under the exception for a business in a new CO'd structure. But in every other aspect, it meets all of the criteria that entitles you to grant the exercise of discretion and permit them to be included in the Bike Week Master Plan. From the standpoint of the application to the Bike Week Master Plan and the City Commission's decision, the process is that an applicant submits, the Bike Week Master Plan Committee screens, and they bring the matter forward to the City Commission with recommendations to include or exclude an applicant from the Bike Week Master Plan. And it is an administrative decision that doesn't have, to my knowledge, any discretionary ability or authority. Some discretion does exist when they look at the nature of an application to see if it's consistent with the other things in the guidelines, but that is not the case in this particular instance, or for that matter, the other case. So the waiver is requested because this is a full-time business. It has a license with the City of Daytona Beach. They have been open continuously since their opening date in early October. I estimate that by the time Bike Week comes, they'll have been open for about 175 days in advance of the event. I hasten to point out the standards say 250 days in advance of the application. But when a business opens, and prior to that, as you know, they've got to secure the premises, make the premises ready, pass inspections, get the licenses, and all those things, often you don't have control of that. The premise may not be available. The point is that the waiver will encourage a business that is opened, committed to doing full-time activity on Main Street, and has demonstrated that already since the beginning of October. I do have two letters that my clients obtained from local businesses just speaking to the nature of their business, and actually the proprietor, primary proprietor, Mr. Mike Masella, in that he has other businesses that these folks know and understand his operation of business.
I'm going to give these to the magistrate and then we can give them to you.
And I offer those to the magistrate for the purpose of demonstrating other people's opinion of the character of the business and the intent that's stated here, that it will be a full-time business. And there is no way to expand the time by the individuals, even by the administrative authority of the city. From a standpoint of the purpose of the legislation, granting the waiver actually encourages what the legislation is seeking, which is full-time businesses that will contribute to the Main Street community and their activities. So on that grounds, respectfully, it's requested that the magistrate grant the waiver. I did talk with city staff a little bit this morning. I don't know if they have any comments, but that's the nature of the request for the waiver.
All right, what's the city's response?
Colleen Miles, zoning officer for the city. At least these guidelines are a little bit more clear than the previous things you've had to review, and it's spelled out pretty concisely. We're looking for year-round businesses. I don't believe the city has an opinion one way or the other than it does not meet the criteria for the 250 days prior to the application deadline.
Where do I find this 250-day requirement again?
Do you have the master plan guidelines, sir?
Yes. It would be the first page of the guidelines, the first paragraph.
Section 1A.
Earlier, and I'm looking for that qualification.
Yes, sir. I think what Ms. Miles handed you was the handout sheet that people work from, Mr. Vakelja. It's Section 1 definitions. And I'm referring to Section 1 of the Bike Week Master Plan guidelines, not an ordinance section.
Business which has been open and operating for a minimum of 250 days, 6 hours per day, during the one-year period immediately preceding the application, or a business which opens and operates in a new structure for which the certificate of occupancy was first issued during the one-year period immediately preceding the application date.
Okay. If I may, Mr. Vakelja, what the ordinance anticipated doing...
And your application date was when?
The application date was the Bike Week Master Plan Guideline date. The business opened... around October 10th is when they got their business tax receipt in order to do business with the city. It was a new business in an existing structure. And
so you got your, what, occupational license October 10th?
Approximately, yes, sir.
And the application deadline was when?
November 20th.
For the Bike Week Master Plan.
And was this business open continuously from October 10th through November 20th?
Yes, sir.
And it's been open continuously to this day?
Yes, sir.
And your estimation is by the time Bike Week arrives, it'll be 175 days they will have been open and in operation?
Round number estimation, lawyer math, approximately 175 days. I never trust lawyer math, but I'm close.
City dispute any of that?
No, sir.
So the question is whether or not I'm going to disqualify you because you didn't build a new structure.
Yes, sir. It's in part. If I may, Mr. Kell, just a little bit more. You had a long discussion about discretion in the prior hearing, and I was listening carefully to that. As I said, the guidelines are administrative guidelines, and the nature of our form of government is that administrators must stick to the guidelines which are given. So this, I don't believe the city staff, or for that matter even the city commission, in the ordinance setup that exists, has the opportunity to exercise discretion.
All right, was your application rejected because you fell short of the 250
yes,
days?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Or did it fall short because somebody took issue with whether or not you were in a new structure and no. qualified at all?
No, it is the 250-day standard, but if I might complete my thought, the discretionary component of this, when the ordinance was drafted, recognized that there would be circumstances where the 250-day timeline was a bright line that cut in a way not necessarily intended by the legislative intent. Therefore, the process was created where the special magistrate undoubtedly has the authority to consider the absence of full compliance with the 250-day standard. That is the only thing that is at issue here. When you look at the criteria where you make a determination of just cause for a waiver, what you will find is that the application is consistent with or the standard is inapplicable to the applicant. We have a corporation and the firm's principal in creating the condition. They did nothing to create it. They simply were able to open their business. When they did, they couldn't expand or shrink time, so that they fell short of the timeline. The gravity of the violation, there is no violation. The purpose of the ordinance is to encourage year-round business. That is what this business is, and it's what it's demonstrated from the time that it opened its doors, and coincidentally, worked its way through Biketoberfest simply as an ordinary business. And they would not have been fairly able to say to the commission, let us go, because Biketoberfest happens, as you know, the latter part of October. And it would certainly appear to be, in that instance, opening the doors just to meet that event. That is not what they have done. They've opened their doors, they've maintained the business continually, and they will continue to do that after the fact. And then the last standard is any prior opportunity to remedy the condition. There simply doesn't exist any prior opportunity to remedy a condition of time. So I think that in all respects, the determination of just cause, applying the standards that you are directed to work under, demonstrates the ability of you to grant the waiver. And in granting the waiver, if you consider the legislative intent of creating the 250-day standard in the first place was to encourage year-round business, and what you have is business that's closing in on 6 months of year-round business already from the day they opened their door. If you go to the other side of it from the administrative perspective, the City Commission has to have, and the staff has to have, some clear, defined methodology for working with the Bike Week Master Plan. There's a huge number of businesses that come. A lot of things occur, so they need a long lead time, and it's understandable that they want to create a filter in order to pursue the legislative intent. But I think everyone involved in the drafting of the ordinance and the folks that administrate the ordinance understand there will be circumstances that don't clearly fit into the round holes created by the code. Therefore, the magistrate has the ability to grant the waiver considering the standards of the ordinance, and I think those standards are met in this case.
Okay. Who is the applicant in this instance?
The applicant is Tim Vaines. He's actually the owner of the company. He's actually listed on the application form, which you may have as a part of your file. And the business is known as Mikey's Love Bar.
Okay. And Mr. Vaines is a resident of this area?
Yes, sir, he is.
And he has a corporation?
He has a corporation.
Florida corporation?
Yes, sir.
So we have a Florida corporation owned by a resident of this area that you're telling me acquired this business and then obtained his occupational license on October 10th. He's been open continuously up to the application deadline, and you're telling me he's still been open continuously since then?
Yes, sir. The only part I would disagree with what you just said was acquiring the business. He actually created the business and put it in place. He has other businesses of a similar vein. The property has been there. It has been used by other occupants in a similar form. But Mr. Vaines and his company are a new operator, obtained the business tax receipt from the city.
Does Mr. Vaines have a lease for this property?
Yes, sir.
Who owns the property?
I'm not sure his record owner is. Excuse me.
Archie Dodani.
Mr. Dodani family owns a lot of property in the Daytona Beach area, a fair amount on Main Street.
Your client has a lease on the property.
Yes, sir.
He's not just some ephemeral business manager who's going to come and go.
No, sir. No, not a sham.
All right. Ms. Miles, to your knowledge, the intent in creating these requirements that a new business basically not be eligible for at least a year, that a new business not be eligible for at least a year before it can participate in Bike Week activities?
The 250 days, yes, sir. The intent was that a trend has been set that businesses move into the Main Street area prior to an event and open stating that they're a year-round business and, in fact, are there to make money during the event and then leave. That has continuously been the situation, and so that's why the guidelines made that requirement of 250. I mean, code goes and counts business days per year.
And so under, as I understand your description of this legislation, say a fellow goes down there and buys property, then he has to wait at least a year before he is eligible to participate in bike week activities.
Yes, sir. Outside vending activity.
Outside vending activities.
Mr. Magistrate, I don't entirely agree with the answer, because you have the exception for a CO. So if it was a new structure, you'd have to get it finished and get a CO. And in that instance, I think the code allows you to do it at any time. If you had remodeling significant enough to cause a new CO to be issued, the exception would apply. From the standpoint of a business, or a building rather, that is occupiable because it's code compliant for life safety and so on, you don't get a CO. What you do is apply for your business tax receipt, what we used to call an occupational license. The city will then send code inspectors to the property to determine, is the zoning appropriate for the business that wants to go there? Is the structure that it will occupy code compliant? And the primary thing is going to be fire extinguishers, fire alarms, exit signs, those things that contribute to life safety. When you have a complete determination of code compliance for zoning, code compliance for structure, you then may receive your business tax receipt if it's an existing structure. On the other hand, if you came to a structure and said, like the location, but I really need to redo this thing, and you pull building permits and you start redoing things within the property sufficient that the building department says, we're issuing the building permits, we'll come back and inspect and issue a new CO. And I can't describe for you the threshold where that occurs, but if you look at the standards that begin the Bike Week Master Plan guidelines, you'll see there is an exception for that instance where the 250-day timeline does not apply. And the recognition is, in that particular case, that you may not be able to get your CO 250 days prior to the Bike Week Master Plan guideline. There is the intermediate position, and that's the position my client finds himself in, where they came to an existing structure, they are new to the area in this business, in this format, and they made their application, obtained their license, and have continuously done business since they opened the door. And Ms. Miles and I are familiar with the idea of people opening just a little bit before in order to qualify. That is not what happened in this particular instance. They actually opened in October. By the time Bike Week of 2013 hits, they will be near the six-month period of doing business. And what that is showing is a continuous intent to comply with the purpose of the statute, which is to have full-time businesses on Main Street. And in every respect, they comply with that. And in seeking your waiver, I look to the standards that you are directed to consider. And as I said, most of those do not apply, but some do. And when I listened to the argument on the prior discussion, my thought was that every word within an ordinance is given meaning because that's the nature of statutory construction. The intent of the commission, I think, was obvious, that there should be some relief valve, in this case the magistrate, to permit a waiver where it appears the legislative intent is being complied with. And I think everything in this instance shows you that the waiver should be granted because the legislative intent is being complied with.
Okay, Colleen, are we in agreement he has the right to apply to it for a waiver?
Yes, sir, he does.
And under what provision are we talking about? We're talking about C,
Section 9
of your...
It's sub 9.
Yeah, the appeal at the very end of your document, sir. The appeal process, they did submit a timely application. And the reason for noncompliance is the provision for 250 days, 6 hours a day, prior to application deadline. I'm sorry.
She's go home and I'm going to paint the words gravity of the violation on the ceiling of my bedroom, so when I wake up and open my eyes, it'll be right there for me to stare at.
I'll be glad to talk with you about that another day. I can talk now, but it doesn't apply here. So.
Okay. Well, again, as a right of appeal, you can ask the magistrate to waive compliance. Determining just cause, I shall consider. There is no fault to be considered. There is no violation to be considered. There is no prior opportunity that the applicant had to remedy the condition to be considered. So, having considered those, what I would call negative determinations, I guess the question remains whether or not just cause has been shown for you to participate, notwithstanding your noncompliance, for not having been in business already 250 days prior to November 20. Okay, I'm going to find that just cause has been shown and that the applicant will be permitted to participate in the... All right, so I'm going to grant the applicant's appeal of denial of participation in the master plan.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay. Is that it?
Just one more.
I'm Kathy Tollison, representing Roar Motorcycles.
Can you raise your hand, please? Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to provide is the truth,
I do. I'm kind of under the same situation, but a little different in the sense I've missed the master plan by 10 days, but I've also been a business owner with a business license for the same business in the city of Daytona Beach for 5 years.
At 897 Bellevue Avenue?
Yes, and I've moved to 420 North Beach Street, and I've also been a resident for 25 years.
And you're shy of the 250 days by 10 days?
By 10 days. And I wouldn't have been if my lease had been signed at time.
Granted.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. That was presumptuous of me.
Sorry about that. The Bike Week Task Force said it's December 20th meeting to review the Bike Week Master Plan. I'm sure you can hear me. Would support your approval of the appeal because they are a year-round business who's been in the community for quite some time.
Well, I appreciate that. And I know they have a tough job, and I know that these are close calls, and I know they have their requirements, and God bless them. They're doing their job. And then, unfortunately, the rubber meets the road right here. That having been said, okay, granted, good luck to you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Now, if there's no other business to be brought before me, and I guess I'll just have a little discussion here. That's easy. That may not be advisable, so never mind. I was going to air out some of the concerns I have with some of the legislation we keep talking about, but I don't know that that would be the prudent thing to do. So, I obviously am having a hard time wrestling with the gravity of the violation. I'm just speaking in the abstract now. I'm not discussing any cases here. And for whatever it's worth, I guess it's also evident that my concern is with a 3-year ban and the financial impact that causes, because relatively speaking, that is a hardship the likes of which we have never visited on any applicant that did things a heck of a lot more egregious than some of the things I've heard mentioned. So for whatever it's worth, it would make things a lot easier if there was some discretion to impose something short of a 3-year ban. I know how to mete out a fine. I know how to punish people when I feel like punishing them. The only words that actually registered with me the whole morning was when that lawyer,
Mr. Foster,
Mr. Foster said the outcome is punitive, and that is prohibited as a matter of law. And maybe it's unfortunate that I'm a lawyer sitting here, but that part I understand. So, in any event, there you go. I guess if anyone were to discuss perhaps revisiting this so we could actually not only put teeth in it, but put manageable, sustainable teeth in it, and I'd be happy to have this conversation with anyone who wants to hear it. Otherwise, like I said, you run the risk of just being found to have been punitive, which is not only wrong, it gets very expensive for the city. There, that was about as nebulous as I can get. Okay, folks, thank you for all your help today. Have a good day.